We will continue now with the second half of the candidate forum for Montana House District 63, 64, and 65, and Senate District 33.
Another question? Yes, ma'am.
I'd like to ask the panel here about the educational system in Montana. I will let you know that I have personal interest. My son is a janitor at Bozeman High, and my daughter's a first-year teacher at CJ. Class sizes are almost impossible to teach.
Oh.
He has...
Okay. We understand your question.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to start with Brian.
Could I ask a quick follow-up question?
It depends on the school. In Belgrade, they're a little smaller, so they're about 16. I worked there briefly, but in hers, they're like 28.
Okay.
Just a little more follow-up information there. I worked in elementary school, and the average class size is running somewhere between 30 and 34 students. It's for one full time teacher.
Between 30 and 34 students, this gentleman says. Okay, Brian?
Well, there you go. We have a funding crisis in education. It's been created over the last 30 years by Republican tax policies. And it's not going to be solved overnight. We have to revise our tax system so that those can afford to pay, and that we can properly fund our school system so teachers pay what they really should be paid, and we're no longer 51st, and that classes and the infrastructure around teachers are reasonable. And this has been going, we are short 1,000 teachers in this state. And we're heading toward a wall, and we're going to have to find the money to fix it.
Chris?
Thank you. I don't pretend to have any kind of deep insights on this one, except to say that we need to pay deep attention to our educational system, right, as we go back into that session. The K-12 system is underfunded right now structurally in a what I would call sort of an existential, crisis. We've got high schools and middle schools that are not paying the bills right now. It's really important that we, as a society, understand how central public education is, not just to the kids, thank God, but and their excellence, but also the importance to the communities. It is the elevator for all kids and families, and it would be heartbreak to lose that. So we have to double down.
Neil?
Yeah, we had five children, and all but one of them went through the public school system, one and a half, actually. That may require explanation, but I won't do it here. But anyways, I don't have a lot of insight into this either, other than experience as a parent and also as a taxpayer. When, I don't know, it's like 85% of the taxes on my property taxes went to the school. That was a pretty giant increase over 1 year, $11,000 on my house. So I went to a revenue seminar put on by the Department of Revenue in Belgrade a couple weeks ago, and the way it looked to me is that the revenue sources are varied that pay for our schools across the state, and that, and maybe Chris can help me with this, that some of our school taxes are actually being spread across the state. You know, what does they call that? Equalization or something. So, yeah, this is going to take a pretty deep dive,
time.
I think. Thank you.
Mark?
Always dangerous to answer education before your opponent, who's a teacher, gets to talk. But I have a brother who's a teacher, not in the state, and my brother-in-law is a teacher at Gallatin High. So I at least have a little perspective. I think fundamentally a lot of these issues relate back to the same thing. There's a distrust that's growing of institutions, particularly government. And at some point, I'll acknowledge that certain people or all the people are going to have to pay more to deal with these things. But here's where I come at education. I'm guessing Peter was a hell of a teacher. I know my brother is. I would be happy to pay more for schools if we change some of the systems. The good teachers get paid the same as the teachers that aren't as good. and trying to find ways to innovate, to reward excellence, and to change some of the systems. I'm not talking about ending tenure, but we've got to create trust in the system differently across all things. Education is the backbone of this country and has made it what it is, and it does take more, but we got to change the system fundamentally.
Peter?
All right. Well, this is an area where we definitely disagree, Mark. yes, we are at the breaking point in our school district right now. I think it's safe to say that most people who have raised their kids in Bozeman are really proud of what they had access to. In so many cities around the country, you know, if you want a great education for your kids, you know, if you're not wealthy, you're going to have a hard time getting it, which is really sad. That's where we've gone over the last few decades. Didn't used to be that way. And here, you still have access to an amazing education in the public schools, but we are at the breaking point. When I first came here in the 90s, we could get any teacher to come here. I had 200 people I was competing with for a job. And when I got hired, I felt so good about myself. Everyone wanted to be here because the cost of living was low enough that we could make it work. And now it's maybe three for a job. That just doesn't work. Part of the problem is our funding formula for the schools in Montana is a mess. So, for instance, we have a I can't talk anymore.
Okay.
I could go on and on and on.
Jolene?
Yeah, so I have looked at that equation on how our public schools are funded, and it is more complicated than I guessed. So I'm a proponent of freedom in education. So there's like charter schools that are starting up in some places. There's private schools, there's homeschools, and there's public schools. So that's really kind of my only public comment is I'm for all of those because we want children to succeed in the best possible way and optimize their future. So.
Okay. And Kelly.
Thank you. Last session, we had a historic budget surplus in the legislature, over $2 billion. Since then, our property taxes have gone up, corporate property taxes have gone down, and schools have cut extracurriculars and teachers and staff. Where was that $2 billion? Where did it go, and why didn't it help shore up our last-in-the-nation starting school salaries for teachers? Why are we training our teachers here at our great public universities and then losing them to Wyoming and California where the salaries are tripled? It's because we're not focused on funding education and making sure that our communities, the core of our communities, is strong. We have to fund it and pay those teachers what they deserve. Thank you.
Another question? Beth?
I have a question about, I heard someone mention voting rights in CI 126 and CI 127, the rank voting constitutional amendment. So I wonder if each candidate can tell us what they recommend.
Neil?
No.
Chris?
Yes. CI 126 and 27 are designed to reduce the amount of polarization and partisanship that happens in the primary system where folks who vote in primaries tend to be a little bit more rabid, and I'm talking about both parties, and I'm not talking about any partisan thing here, but I'm just saying primaries produce folks who are high on the hog about exactly what they think, but there's no choices towards the middle, it turns out, and that's just statistical. And so long and short, I think CI 126 and 27 are meant to calm the waters, to try and get more people involved, to give voters a better choice. And ultimately, I think there should be a sunset on that one so that we can see if it works. Alaska is doing a very nice job with that and apparently really likes the program. Thank you.
Peter?
Yeah, as somebody who brought that up, really, thank you. Yes, I'm a big fan of 126, 127 for reasons I think that Chris really touched on. You know, there are a lot of folks who don't have a way to have a voice in our political system right now. If you are not, if you are in the middle somewhere, you know, it is hard to get yourself in the game. So, for instance, if you're a moderate, you know, you've got to compete in a primary where, say, only a very small part of the of that party is participating, and you know, they likely, as Chris pointed out, skew to one side, so you're kind of left out of the equation. So I would say a change like this really encourages independents and moderates to get more involved, and it ends up with a higher likelihood of people getting elected who really represent their community.
Mark?
I worry about unintended consequences. And as a Republican, sometimes I find it hard that I'm the one about to say this. I think in a state where you have a supermajority of a party, the idea that you could end up with more districts where only one party's represented in the general election is a bad idea. That doesn't mean I'm necessarily against it, but I don't understand how we're in a state. It's healthy to have both Democrats and Republicans in elected bodies, so there can be debates. I mean, I think we're living proof that moderates can come through a primary, and I understand that doesn't happen everywhere. But I'm worried in Montana that one party, the party I'm actually affiliated with, it has too much of a voice, and I'm worried that those ballot initiatives would make it even harder for Democrats to have a broader access. So for that reason, I'm against it, because I want to make sure that every general election has both parties represented.
Okay. Kelly?
Thank you. I watched a video on instant runoff elections in 2014, and I was convinced and have studied it a lot since then. That's been 10 years ago. I'm excited that our state is looking at a runoff or an instant runoff election mixed with a top four primary. It should reduce extremism. It should eliminate strategic voting so we can all vote our conscience and not have to worry about how my neighbor's voting, which often happens. We don't have to worry about splitting the vote. If two Democrats are on the ballot and one Republican, that could split the vote and give the win to a non-majority holder. So there's a lot of upsides to instant runoff elections, and I'm really excited to see how Montana feels. I'm really strong on that. Thank you.
Jolene?
So no on CI 127 and no on 126, and I wish they would have, instead of put all this energy on this, I wish we would have focused on hand counting our ballots and getting rid of our tabulators so we could actually say we locally run our elections.
Okay. And Brian?
I have very mixed feelings about this initiative. I think it will result in more moderate Republicans being elected, some in seats that would have been Democratic seats. And having been someone who's been through two primaries, I'm not looking forward to potentially three elections. A primary, a general election, and then the legislature may decide to have a third election to pick the majority winner. That being said, I think this is a necessary evil. I am going to vote for it.
Okay. Another. Yes, sir.
Yeah, just two quick yes-no questions for all the candidates. My first one, have you heard of polio? And second, do you think vaccines work?
Okay, but you have a minute to talk about that, and I'm going to call on Mark first. I promise you, Julian, you'll be after these two guys.
I have heard of polio. I actually had a grandparent who was stricken with polio. To your question of whether vaccines work, I think overall vaccines are effective. I do think that forced vaccination is an issue that needs to be addressed, but polio is a great example of where vaccination has largely eradicated a disease that afflicted large parts of this country. Sorry, you said yes or no, but so yes, I've heard of it, and I do support vaccinations.
Okay, Peter?
Yes, I've heard of it, and yes, I support vaccinations.
Jolene.
Awesome. I'm going to talk for 45 minutes, and we're going to start at Nuremberg.
No, you
and
can't.
We're get-
you get a minute.
I'm kidding. All right, so I'm giving out this DVD. It's Vaxxed. This has the testimony of the whistleblower at the CDC that says, we know what we're doing to kids, we know we're causing autism, and we're covering it up. And he has filed for whistleblower status. He has not been allowed to talk to Congress. You're welcome to take copies of it. I want everybody to have it. Sorry?
Released in 2021.
It's older than that, but it's been censored. So it's like 2017. All right. So the next point I want to bring out is that the conflict of interest that goes on In 1986, Congress passed the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, freeing the companies from liability for injuries resulting from the childhood vaccines, no matter how toxic the ingredients. We've paid out over $4.2 billion for vaccine injury. Dr. Susan Humphreys has a book on polio. I suggest you read it. It's called Dissolving Illusions.
Kelly?
Yes, I've heard of polio, and yes, vaccines eradicated polio.
Done. Brian?
100 years ago, there were thousands of iron lungs across this country helping people breathe because they had polio. Polio is a disease. It's dangerous. I believe in vaccines. I'm endorsed by Montana Families for Vaccines. And nobody has a civil right to be a disease vector. Thank you.
Chris?
I know what polio is, and I'm incredibly thankful for vaccines. I think it's a miracle. And I certainly wouldn't be here if you know, 200 years ago there weren't vaccines. So, or whatever. It's probably historically inaccurate, but oh well. Thank you.
Neil?
Yes, I've heard of polio. My mother had polio, and I didn't, nor did my seven siblings. So that vaccine worked. Do all of them? How many are there? Does anybody know? Jolene, do you know?
62 now on the childhood schedule. It's off the charts.
Yeah, and when our kids were young, it was probably 6. And that seemed to have gotten them all through. They're all still alive. Now they're all walking around.
Okay. Another question. Are we done with questions? Folks, last call. Okay, Beth, go crazy.
My question is, how much should the legislators be involved in library governance?
How much should legislators be involved in the library?
Library governance.
Okay. Kelly?
Thanks for the question. Much like how school boards work, they work at the local level. Every community is different. Every community school board knows the needs of the community. So I would say that's best. The governance is best kept at the local level, where we know what we need here. And I guess that's my answer. Thank you.
Jolene?
So I've tried to get some information into the libraries that they won't allow in their collection. So that I don't know that that really answers your question. I do think they should be local governed, but there's more censorship here on this kind of topic than I would have ever guessed. I tried to donate a $400 DVD set to this library, and I didn't bring the rejection letter to read. I was going to. Anyway, it just says, well, it lacks professional sources. That entire set is scientists, doctors, and attorneys talking on that subject. And for whatever reason, it just said lacks professional sources. So, yeah, we need local control, but there's censorship here that you don't realize until you want people to have more information.
Brian?
So I look at the craziness that's going up in Flathead County with their library right now, and I have to think, is that something we should do something about? And I have to think, unfortunately, the answer is no. Flathead has to fix Flathead, and thankfully we have a strong library community here in Gallatin County, in Bozeman, in Belgrade, in Manhattan. They all work together. They all share resources. They all share expertise, and they're all committed to the freedom to read. And so, you know, even when you have an insane situation like what's going up in the Flathead, where they're lowering standards and they ban Book Week. Think of that, okay? So an employee actually had her own banned Book Week out on the street. Check my Facebook page. So I don't think it's our job to intervene. Flathead's going to have to work out its own problems.
Neil?
Just as clarification, they're not totally locally governed. We have a library commission, and they have an influence across the entire state. So why don't we just let it play out and see what happens, you know?
Chris?
Well, one of my precepts is that legislators make very bad managers, and it's not part of our role. We do have most of the time, a funding role. There's the commission, which I'm not familiar with, but my heart breaks to know that there has been a visceral, symbolic approach to libraries as being at the heart of some problem. You know, I just think that's very unfortunate, and I'm glad it didn't happen when I was a kid. And I think that the local communities need to have the ability to decide where they want to be on something like that. And of course, you know, then we would all have to support our local libraries. Thank you.
Peter?
Sure. I'm not a fan of banning books. Going back to that topic in the conversation, I don't know a lot about the structure of library governance, to be honest. But yeah, I don't like the idea of legislators being in charge of running things. As Chris was pointing out, that just seems really odd. And going back to bloated bureaucracy, that certainly sounds like it. As somebody in the schools, I have to say, you know, I followed what the education committee was about a lot last session. And one of the things that was really troubling to me was that a lot of time was spent in that committee talking about which books should be banned rather than trying to solve our school problems. And, you know, there's no leader in the schools, for instance, who would say that the problem is that their libraries have, you know, books that we don't want kids reading. I would say there are no leaders in the state who would probably say that to you. They have much bigger problems they got to deal with.
And Mark?
I certainly did not get in this race to be involved in legislating libraries. I think the ability to give young people in particular, access to information, any information, is again something that makes this country so unique. And I think a local community certainly needs to have leadership over community assets like libraries and swimming pools. But I don't believe at the state level, beyond funding, there's a role in legislating what's appropriate for books. Fundamentally, I think that's my job as a parent. And I'm glad there's a library like this in this community. I've spent many hours picking up kids and sitting with kids as they come in and out of these doors. So thank you for what you do.
Yes, ma'am. Sure.
I'd like to know how each of you stand on CA 128.
Okay. Okay, Brian, we're starting with you.
The first article on the right to privacy was written by future Justice Brandeis in 1896, where he discussed the concept of the right to be left alone. And that's a very Montanan thing, right? Unless you're stuck at the side of the road, like I was in 1994 at a wedding, and someone stopped by and gave us a gallon of gas. But that is the whole thing. I was knocking doors, and someone said, young woman said, this right probably isn't important to you. I said, the diminution of anyone's rights is a diminution of all our rights. People have the right to be who they want to be and have children when they want to have them, and the state has no business entering the doctor, patient, parent, child, or woman choice relationship. That's why we have the right to privacy. Thank you.
Chris?
I very much support CI 128 and think that this goes right to the heart of everything I think everybody in this room would say starts to be a conversation which has to do with liberty and privacy and freedom. And, of course, it has to do with healthcare as well and other things. But, it kind of blows me away that we have gotten to this point. I'm very excited that the state of Montana gets to express itself on this, and I certainly will be in favor.
Neil?
Personally, I'm very much a pro-life individual. The problems I see in 128 is really not the discussion of pro-life or pro-choice. The CI is written so broadly. There could be five different CIs out of that one initiative. I don't have it in front of me, so I can't pull those elements out. But It is a lawyer's heaven. And we're going to see years and years and years of litigation over the way that is written and the language that's in it. So I think it should be rejected. And if somebody wants to take another run at it with clearer language, more succinct language, et cetera, and I'll leave you with this. There's another individual involved in this, and that's a human baby. So as we think about pro-choice, we have to think about what it is and who it is we're actually killing.
Mark?
There's probably not an issue I've struggled with personally as I prepare for this election. I believe a right to choose already exists in Montana's Constitution. I'm an attorney by training. There's an express right of privacy that doesn't exist in the U.S. Constitution that exists in Montana's. I, to Neil's point, the issue where it says you can't put a burden on abortion is a lawyer's nightmare, because I have a 16-year-old daughter. I think as a parent, I should have to be consulted before my minor child accesses an abortion. But is that a burden? It's a lawsuit waiting to happen. The issues become so divisive that I think 128, I will vote in support of it, even though I don't like the way it's written, because I think it would create ambiguity about whether the right already exists. But I think whether it was intentionally done or not, it was written in a way, again, I don't think most people would say a parent can't assist a child who's in their care before
time
she accesses that procedure, but the language makes it unclear.
Jolene?
Peter.
Peter, I'm sorry.
No problem. Yes, I am a big supporter of I-128. I have daughters, two of them. I have a mother. I have lots of women in my family. And I, frankly, it's hard for me to watch what it feels as though the rights of my kids, my daughters, could be less than the rights of my mother. And that doesn't seem right. So, and when I'm talking about rights, I mean, the right to bodily autonomy is bottom line, it seems to me. I mean, I think right to privacy is, you know, is bottom line, honestly, as well. You know, when someone has to make a decision about whether they're having children, that should be between them and, you know, their medical professionals, and it's a hard choice, and I don't think anyone goes into that decision lightly.
Okay. Now, Jolene. Sorry, Peter.
So I'm a former director of a pro-life crisis pregnancy center in Livingston, and I will tell you the conversation that you have with young girls is very different than this political swirl. We have to remember the scriptures tell us that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And I think when we're talking about things of life and death, we need a lot of wisdom and that comes from him. And so when we have girls that are in these situations, they need companionship and they need someone to talk to and they need some understanding. And I don't think we need to open the door to this. I will be voting no on this initiative.
Kelly?
Thank you. I support everyone's bodily autonomy and privacy rights. I am thankful that this is on the ballot because through the initiative process, the citizens get to vote on it directly without the legislature weighing in. So that takes out some middlemen, a lot of special interest groups and lobbyists. So we get to ask the citizens of Montana what they think. And I think that's beautiful. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, sir, in the back.
What role, if any, should the state have in disaster preparedness?
What role should the state have in disaster preparedness? Is that the question? Okay.
Fire, drought, you know, I think pretty timely with North Carolina and Florida. Yeah.
Okay. Neil?
The state has a lot of built-in resources between its firefighting capacity, its National Guard, its first responders. To utilize all of those or to have a plan in place that can utilize all of those. They're all being paid in any case. It seems a pretty reasonable thing to me.
Chris?
Yes, in the Energy Committee, we have been studying wildfire, and that's probably the first major conversation on something like that. You know, tens of millions and on a bad year, hundreds of millions have been set aside for wildfire management from at the state level for the budget. And I think that because of the potential for it to cross political boundaries, communities, because of the significance of the hazard itself, I think the state has to be involved. I think the state also is going to take a position on insurance, which is, you know, if we're going to protect our homeowners and our citizens from insurance companies pulling out or doing weird stuff, I'm sure that's happening in Florida right now. The state has a very important role there, and we're going to have that conversation this session, I'm pretty sure. Thank you.
Peter?
It's a very interesting question. I'm going to be honest here and say that I know very little about the subject. I found Chris's comment interesting about insurance. I think that that would be a key point. I think it's one of the harder aspects, strangely, with all the tragedy going on, to consider. But yes, the state has to have a big role in something like this. And I'd like to think that we would have a plan, all kinds of plans. And, you know, a climate change being what it is, there's no doubt we're going to see more of this even here away from the ocean.
Mark?
It made me have a flashback to sitting in the hallway in elementary school and holding a book over my head in the event of nuclear war. So I'm dating myself. I do want to echo. I think the issue of insurance is really key, particularly even around things that I wouldn't necessarily say are disasters, but the number of homeowners in Montana that were dropped from their carrier after hailstorms is surprisingly high. And I do think the insurance commissioner's office needs to very much say if you're in this state, you have to make commitments about coverage. And you know, fortunately, we don't have a lot of flooding, but it's becoming more and more common for insurance companies to just drop coverage after a claim is made. And I think that area should be strongly looked at by the state as it goes forward.
Kelly?
The State Department of Emergency Services, DES, testified this summer that they were very low on employees and that they had 80 to 90% turnover since COVID and the floods a couple years ago. So this is a very big state. Incidences are increasing with climate change and with more residents. More residents means more human-caused wildfires. So instead of watching agency struggle to hire folks, we should not only get them hired, get them trained because the turnover has been high, so they're not quite as experienced in this field. So, again, it comes down to what our priorities are and what we fund, and this is a thing we should certainly fund to help mitigate future disasters. Thank you.
Jolene?
My answer to your question is a question. Are we as a state funding things that makes this idea worse? Like when we do cloud seeding things, are we actually putting like aluminum into the atmosphere that actually makes our forests burn hotter? It's a question. I don't know the answer, but it has been done elsewhere. So I think it's important for our state to not exacerbate potential situations.
And Brian?
Having had my insurance pulled 1 month before it was up for renewal because I had two hailstorm claims, I have no love for insurance companies. That said, I have to wonder whether we have an obligation to insure people who build their houses in the middle of a forest ready to burn up, and whether we should apply public resources to save their lives and maybe try to save their structures, but I'm not sure we should apply public resources. I'm going to sound like a conservator. We should apply public resources to insure their houses when they build in insane places. I don't know what's in Missoula. There's a whole neighborhood that can't get insurance right now because of the fire danger. And I don't have a solution. The solution in Florida was to the state to create their own insurance company backed by the state, backed by the taxpayers. So if something goes really bad in Florida, all the taxpayers will automatically have to pay more to the state to pay for that. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I'm concerned that best pay and benefits I've got working in these areas. So collective, what would you do to support organized labor and workers' rights?
Well, can you repeat the last part of it? What would you do?
Support organized labor and workers' rights.
Okay. So everybody got the question? Okay. Let's start with Peter.
Thank you for the question. I've been a union member for 30 years. I work for MFPE, actually. In fact, I got into this because in the last part of my career, I was doing legislative organizing for MFPE at night, and I found it to be very productive and interesting. So I guess I would say in my case, you know, I'm a big proponent for making sure that working people are looked after, that they are not taken advantage. When I say looked after, I mean, you know, we protect them from being abused by owners in particular. So, yes, we need to make sure that people in the workplace are safe, that they have access to group bargaining situations and so on. I guess I have a few more seconds. But, yeah, working people are the heart and engine of this economy. You know, we like to think sometimes that it's the elite who own these big companies who you hear about in the news, but they are not the people doing the work. The people doing the work are the people working in those businesses and organizations.
Mark?
Thank you. I think Montana has a great environment relative to other states. We're one of the only states that are not a right to an at-will state. So I think there's a good environment that should remain in place. I think the freedom to choose whether a workforce unionizes is an essential right. I think it exists, and I think it should be protected. I think Neil will echo this. As an employer, I agree with what Peter said, I think having open dialogue with employees and providing good answers as an employer is essential. And again, I find the environment in Montana to be very favorable to employees in that regard of able to organize and able to associate with unions if that's their choice.
Kelly?
I do support the rights of workers to organize their workplace. I am endorsed by the MFPE and the AFL-CIO, both all three elections so far. I'm glad that there's people looking out for the rights of some of our workers. That said, I think there's a lot of workers that don't have folks looking out for them. And who has time as an individual to lobby for a minimum wage increase? Because minimum wage isn't really affected by unions. So I think there's a lot of work to be done outside of union work, and I encourage more workplaces to consider unionizing to protect their rights and the rights of their colleagues. Thank you.
Jolene?
Yeah, I just need more information on the topic before I give public comment. Thanks.
Neil?
None of my businesses were unionized. I did grow up in a union shop. My father's shop in roofing company was unionized, so I've had a little experience from that. I believe if a group of people want to unionize, it's a free country, or supposed to be. That's fine. I don't believe in forced unionism. I don't think anybody should be forced to join a union or pay dues to a union in order to work in a given place. If that's called right to work, then I guess I'm a right to work state guy. And in my experience, the way we paid our employees, they made more than union workers made in the construction industry in Montana. And because we created incentive programs that were very attractive, helped keep good employees, and they were able to buy their homes and so on and so forth. So I really do ultimately believe in the free market, but unions are part of the free market, so thank you.
Chris?
Thank you. I'm supported by the AFL-CIO and MFPE based on my voting record, so I am all in. I appreciate the history of unions in the sense of the development of the middle class, and I think this country needs a little bit more of that kind of structural reinforcement to our communities. I will say that I'm working really hard with various of the union reps up in the Capitol building to try and encourage more of a conversation with the new energy economy, renewables and storage and wind solar and so forth. Because I think there's a tremendous opportunity in the state of Montana, and we still have to do that work. but it's the conversation is starting to happen. Thank you.
Brian?
So full disclosure, I am endorsed by MFPE and AFL-CIO and the Locomotive and Boiler Engineers. And I live in a union household. That said, I will oppose any right-to-work legislation. And I have to say that I am concerned about the pressures put on people trying to unionize. I remember when I was at HRDC on the board, there was a big effort, which I just never got comfortable with, to try to prevent the Head Start teachers from organizing. You know, that was one reason why I was separated from the board. And I think California just passed a law to bar mandatory anti-union meetings by employers, and I would support something like that.
Okay, I think we're going to do a wrap-up now. Everybody gets 2 minutes, and I don't want to constrain anybody, so you don't have to. You want to be first, Peter? Fine. Go. 2 minutes.
So again, thank you to our hosts for putting this together and for everyone for staying for quite some time. I really appreciate it, this kind of meaningful conversation. I wish we had more opportunities to really talk about all these issues of such import and more, really. So I started tonight by talking about how, you know, as a family and my family and as a teacher, you know, I want to leverage my teaching skills and what I've learned in that world to advocate for regular folks. And we're talking about union people. I'm talking about regular folks here, so that everybody has access to what I would call the Montana dream. So, I mean, I really do think that the sort of Montana dream is slightly off from the American dream somehow. And so what does that look like? I thought I would maybe spell that out. It means, for instance, we have to make sure, we've touched on public schools, but we need to make absolutely sure that everyone who is here, they can get their kids into some good schools. And that's just bottom line. We need to make sure that we have access to public lands. That is something we have not talked about tonight. But, you know, our public lands really are at risk right now. Not everyone is making a real effort to conserve them, to take care of them, to make sure that they are here forever. And that's really concerning to me, because once, or the more that that goes away, the more we lose, I would say, our identity as Montanans. But everyone needs access. We have wealthy landowners, frankly, a lot of them who don't even live here, who have spent lots of money lobbying to make sure that regular folks cannot access public lands. That is a problem. But we need to make sure we all have access to good health care. We need to make sure that, housing. We've got to find some way to make sure that we deal with the costs related to housing so that people can actually live here and thrive here.
Who wants to be next? Doesn't matter. However you want to do it.
I'd echo the thoughts of thank you for organizing this and giving us the opportunity to be here. I'm encouraged tonight because it's been a discussion about issues and not about name calling. I'm convinced Peter's a good guy. We don't know each other historically. We're both competitive, and I hope the people in House District 63 feel like they have two good choices. It's not about right or wrong, and that's how elections are supposed to be. I'm a traditional Republican in the sense that I think governments, by definition, are inefficient. That doesn't mean they don't do wonderful things. But I think I Googled affordable housing today before coming here, and 480,000 hits came up. The Affordable Housing Institute on their website says every city in America has an affordable housing issue right now. Markets are efficient, but not in the short term. You look around Bozeman, I'm encouraged by how many housing units are starting. I think the solutions to affordable housing are community-based and not government-driven. I think the thing that I hear more than anything is people feel like they pay more than their fair share to government. And I got involved in this because I'm worried about the burdens that government is leaving for my children, as I said. It doesn't mean, again, that I'm anti-government. I just think a business background that I have provide solutions. But again, I'm blessed that the people in House District 63 have two choices that are good, and I say that publicly. But I still hope people will vote for me, and I'm sure Peter hopes the same for himself. But again, I thank you for letting us be here tonight to have that discussion, and I'm glad it was a civil night of discussion and not name-calling, because that, to me, is a really critical issue. And to all the candidates sitting up here, thank you for being willing to do this. I think we'd all say there are moments we, our spouses say, what in the heck are you doing running for office? But I'm glad the people here are all taking that opportunity. So thank you.
So I'm just going to read off my flyer that I have hit some doors with. I am for medical freedom. I'm for private property rights. I'm for fossil fuels. I'm for protecting children, for hand counting our ballots, and I'm for the Second Amendment. I'm trying to get folks to go and look at Montana Free Press's election guide for 2024. They've done a really good job composing and compiling a lot of information. Kelly Cordham has been to Helena. He has a voting record. I haven't been to Helena. I don't have a voting record. But there are questions on there, and you can click back and forth and see how we think and see kind of our thought process on there. So I'm trying to get everybody to go and look at that website and get more information.
Thank you. And I would like to echo what Mark said. I appreciate a very civil and constructive conversation here. This is how it should be, instead of what we see on TV every night. I am proud of the reason I got involved, and that is I wish every Montana kid has the same opportunities I got. And I'm not sure that's the case anymore, and we should work to correct that immediately. I grew up, I was born in 1985, so the 80s and 90s economies were affecting us, but Montana kept it together. The public schools are strong. That's changing. A lot of our institutions need support and long-term thinking, and that's what I care about in government, is making a sustainable system to where everybody can prosper, and not just survive, but prosper. Thank you.
Yeah, since last November, I've been meeting voters in House District 65, hearing their concerns. I met literally the first door I knocked on was a widow thinking about moving because her property taxes had doubled. I met renters squeezed by management companies with stack like cordwood or facing outrageous fees. I met people living in trailer parks worried that there are lots that their homes around are going to be undersold. I have like five trailer parks in my district, including the largest in the county. I met people worried about high housing costs and threats to their neighborhoods. I met seniors who aren't being treated with dignity that they're entitled to in apartment buildings. I've met teachers barely paid above minimum wage. And everywhere I've met, I've also met people of all genders and persuasions fearful that their rights are under assault, including being who they are, who they want to be, and making their own reproductive choices. So the people in my district have given me an agenda to create a fair property tax system, to protect tenants from exploitation, to let local government make planning decisions, including affordable housing, to fight for seniors' dignity and security, and to defend your civil rights, including reproductive freedom. Their agenda is my agenda. That's why I went out and knocked on doors for a year to find out what the people in my district wanted. And I will work for them doggedly, like I have for the Bozeman community for these last 30 years, to make their views heard and their rights protected.
Okay.
Thanks to the League and for everybody being here. We've had a robust conversation, 2 hours, and that has gone pretty quickly for me, and a lot of good ideas floated here. So I'm running because important work remains unfinished after 8 years in the legislature. Some of the remaining work is, or a lot of it is policy work, but frankly, some of the work is leadership. And it's timely and critical because I think we all feel that something just doesn't feel right in Montana's state government. And it needs fixing, in my opinion. And I'm going to be a little bit sharp-edged here, and this is not for anyone in this room. I've really appreciated the tone of this conversation. And if we could bring this into the state capitol, we'd be all set. We can debate the underlying reasons for why the government needs fixing, but I'll offer that we suffer from this hyper-partisanship that's gained traction, and it pops up. It's like a whack-a-mole. It comes up every once in a while. That has turned the majority party, which I think happens regardless of Democrat, Republican. If you're in the supermajority, it turns the supermajority party into a hot mess. We had 16 out of 50 in the Senate, and we were the largest caucus. The 34 Republicans were split into three different groups. I'm going to run right out of time here. But I want to just say that it's really important at this point that we have moderate, civil, pragmatic, and democratic voices that Montanans have known and voted for generations on both sides of the aisle. I could go on, but the Montana voters are the referees. They're now in the driver's seat. And on November 5, they have to do an important job. And I'm out of time. But I just hope we can get back to work with civility and purpose and protect our Constitution and respect each other. Thank you.
Neil, you get the last word.
I was going to say maybe you need a switch. You know, you can shut the mic off like some right. other... Yeah. Operations. But, thank you, Chris. Mr. Close said something at a little get-together with the Builder Association some time ago that I've said myself, and I don't think we agree on maybe a lot of stuff, but I do agree on this. No single party or single person has all the ideas, nor the best ideas, and to be able to discuss from the ground up some of these issues ultimately can bring out the best ideas or can coalesce into the best ideas and the best legislation. And I think this is what's lacking in CI 128. I'll just add that. That never was able to happen. So that's why I think it's such a bad law. So my program is life, liberty, opportunity, and responsibility. I don't think state government should try to solve every problem. As Mark put so well, the free market is very efficient, but it's slow. If you ever tried to get a loan, if you ever tried to build anything in the city of Bozeman, as I have, believe me, it's slow. They're also incentivized to do big projects and not the little ones, so because they're a self-funded branch. So thank you for this opportunity. It's actually been pretty fun. Thank you.
I want to thank all of the candidates. I think it's amazing that you're willing to run for office. There's no way in the world I would do that. It's endless work, thankless work. And everybody hassles you. So it would be much more fun to stay home. So I appreciate your participation. And also for those of you who came and asked such interesting, important questions of these candidates. So thanks so much.
That wraps up the candidate forum for Montana House District 63, 64, and 65, and Senate District 33, held at the Bozeman Public Library on October 9th, 2024. As a reminder, KGVM does not endorse or support or oppose any candidate or ballot issue. We provide these recordings of candidate forums for voter information purposes.